again, and welcome to another episode of the Live It Well podcast. I'm your host, Richard, and I hope, above all else, you are living it well. I just spent the weekend up at a lake in North Iowa. It was a good kind of R&R, even though we got downpoured on and didn't get to spend as much time on the lake as we wanted. That's the way life goes. But it was good to get away, have a little good food, good company, and a little R&R. So this week's episode is with a fellow Iowan, Nate Sanderson, and found him randomly on Twitter. And there's a movie, if you're a sports movie buff, that is based in Iowa from the late 80s called Field of Dreams. And there is a line in that movie that says, if you build it, he will come. I'm not going to ruin the movie for you, but it's true. And Nate is a testament to that. He didn't build the baseball field in Dyersville, Iowa. He built a wiffle ball field near Iowa City. And it's equally impressive, equally awesome. And it was such a great conversation to talk to Nate, a basketball coach, sports fan, and just all-around good guy. So please, please enjoy this conversation I had with fellow Iowan, Nate Sanderson, who is definitely living it well.
It's so great to have you join the Live It Well podcast. You've got kind of an interesting background, interesting story, a really cool piece that we'll get to as well. But, you know, you're a coach. And so I'm just really curious with COVID and schools, how has all of that kind of impacted your approach so far?
Yeah, that's been an interesting challenge, I think, for everybody. You know, it kind of looks a little bit different depending on, in the coaching world, what your schools will allow and, you know, just kind of what the situation is. But for us, you know, it's just been a matter of trying to stay in contact with players and your coaches and try and find ways to connect even if you're not able to be together in the gym. And as a basketball coach, we're recording this, you know, early in July. I just took a position as a assistant coach with one of my friends here in the area at North Lynn High School, and we had our first chance to get kids, you know, in the gym yesterday. And so, you know, it was great to finally get back into it a little bit, obviously with some restrictions there, but you just do what you can and, you know, hope you can sort of maintain and continue to build relationships with kids, as, even if you're not able to, you know, spend as much time in person with them as you might normally at this time of year.
So with Iowa high school regs, are you in this situation? Are you allowed to, you know, text or email or like any kind of communication in that way? I'm just curious.
Yeah, that depends a little bit. The state for basketball coaches just allowed contact with players on July 1st. So prior to that was technically our no contact period. So, yeah, coaching contact, however that's defined, you know, which is a bit of a, probably a great definitional area, you know, but yeah, that's kind of what the guidelines have been, so.
Yeah. I remember, so I played high school tennis back in the day, and I remember coach being, you know, there was only times he could talk to us about tennis. He was a teacher, so like if you knew him as a teacher, you could obviously talk to him about school stuff, but that's got to be hard to develop relationships, especially with some of the new regulations, just from the health side, especially with in a sport like basketball, where it's very much you've got to have those relationships on and off the court.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, part of the foundation of my coaching philosophy is, you know, you're trying to get to know the person that you're coaching, not just coaching a particular sport. So, you know, you can still have those kind of conversations and connections and, you know, kids are struggling with all of those limitations just as much as coaches, you know, in terms of not being able to be with their teammates or not being able to work out, you know, as much as they'd want to or whatever. So, I think the more that you can be alongside them just in a supportive way, you know, the better.
So that leads me to a question I wanted to ask. If you could summarize or if there's some kind of five-point plan. What's kind of your coaching philosophy and how you approach the athletes that you work with?
Yeah, you know, the way I typically talk about that, I guess I would start by saying, you know, we really try to distinguish between our objective as coaches and our purpose for our program. So like any coach in any other sport, you know, we're going to do a lot of work to try to win games. And that's obviously our objective and kind of what drives us. It's why we watch the film and lift the weights and do the stuff in the off season. But I think that when you're talking about making an impact and being, you know, having a transformational influence on the life of a young person, there's got to be more to it than that. And so, you know, our purpose in coaching is not to win. That's our objective. But we kind of outline pretty specifically three things that we want kids to walk away from when they're done playing with us. You know, the first one is we just want them to know that they were loved, you know, that their coaches love them, their teammates love them, that they were accepted, you know, that they had a place that they belong. The second thing is that their value does not come from what they can do with the ball. I mean, their value as a player and maybe what they can do on the court, you know, is a different conversation about performance. But everybody brings something different to our team, and we really try to, as much as we can, to be able to honor that, you know, whether that's as a teammate, whether that's off the bench as an encourager, you know, whatever it might be. We want players to feel like, you know, they're valued as people, regardless of how good or bad they may be with a basketball. And the third one is that they've been uniquely created to make a positive difference in the world. So, you know, in our programs, we've been really active in community service and raising money and doing, you know, volunteering at nursing homes and things like that, just to try to, you know, establish and get them some experience in serving others, you know, and trying to maybe make a sacrifice on a Saturday morning to go play games down at the old folks home or whatever it might be, because we want them leaving our program with that mentality that I can make a difference in the lives of other people. And so we try to walk them through that.
So I think that leads, I think I know what the answer to this question is going to be, what in your mind makes a good coach?
Well, again, I would start with you're caring for people, you know, more than you're coaching a sport. And so somebody that's able to build relationships and to be able to inspire players to be their best, not just on the court but off the court. And obviously there's things, you know, tactically and technically and knowledge of the sport that's important too. But I think ultimately, you know, as coaches, hopefully we don't want to be measured just by our record when we're all done, you know, but we're looking back at the relationships that have endured, you know, past graduation, past when the ball stops bouncing. You know, are we still able to make a difference in the lives of our alumni, you know, and that kind of thing. So, to me, that's that purpose-driven mentality is the most important thing.
And how long have you been a coach?
I've been doing this for 18 years, so
a full generation of kids have come through you. Well, in that time, I'm curious because I'm now almost. Well, yeah, I am 18 years out of my high school career, the only athletic career I ever had. How have players changed in the course of your coaching?
That's an interesting question. I always tell people that I started teaching in 2002, and I felt like the place that I started, it was like right at the end of the glory years of teaching. Like, there wasn't that much paperwork. There wasn't, you know, nearly as many hoops that you have to jump through. There wasn't No Child Left Behind. You know, they're just, not that there wasn't oversight, but there was just a lot more freedom in the classroom. And I think there was maybe more buy-in with kids. And, you know, so you got to enjoy that for a while. And I think coaching is probably similar. I don't know, you know, again, I don't know that it's kids have changed as much as maybe our parenting strategies have changed. But I think today, you know, we spend a lot more time paying attention to the emotional well-being of our players, talking about the experience that they want to have, you know, what they want it to feel like when they come to practice or when they're in the locker room, or, you know, what it means to be a great teammate and how that makes other people feel and how we play when we feel better because we enjoy being around each other. And I don't know that I didn't do a lot of those things when I started in my career. I don't know that's because kids have changed. I just think that, you know, they mature a little bit more slowly than what they maybe did 20 years ago. And I think there's a lot of research to support that. And I just, again, kids today that have been raised on iPads and the screens and social media, to just have, it's a different emotional landscape. It's a different developmental environment than what, you know, you and I aren't that old, but I mean, we had phones on the wall even when I was a kid, you know, and so didn't grow up with, you know, pictures of me on Facebook and all the way through my childhood and things like that. So it's just a different set of pressures that that maybe we didn't experience when we were kids.
You know, that's so funny because, so I've got a 16-month-old daughter, and I've thought about that, like how her life is going. I mean, every generation had that, right? Things change, and that's kind of the evolution of life, but how different her life is going to be and how I need to parent to ensure that she can be successful. You know, we kind of make, every generation makes it up as they go. So this is probably a loaded question, but you work with the kids. So what advice do you have for parents to raise the best kids? It's probably the worst question, but I'm just kind of curious from your perspective.
No, I think that's a really valuable question. We have two kids ourselves. We've got a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old. So, you know, my wife and I are having these discussions all the time. And I come back to, not to give a plug for random authors out there, but Tim Elmore has some really great stuff on just parenting and parenting, you know, kids in Generation Z and what have you. And kind of the foundation of his approach is, you know, are we preparing the past for the child or the child for the past? And I think if parenting is kind of swung irresponsibly and not necessarily intentionally, but in one direction, it's been, you know, to try to remove obstacles and challenge and struggle. And, you know, we try to prevent our kids from having negative emotional experiences. And the problem with that is that when they become adults or they become high school athletes or they get to college, they don't have the skills to be able to regulate their emotions in a healthy way or to be able to, you know, endure struggle or to continue through challenge to accomplish whatever they want to accomplish. And I feel that, you know, completely as a, even though my kids are still young, you know, I don't like to see them suffering or crying or upset or not get what they want or whatever it might be. But I'm trying to be cognizant of the fact that that's really important for their development. And the more that we rob kids of opportunities to experience struggle and model struggle, even as parents and adults for them, you know, we're taking away the opportunity for them to develop those skills, those coping skills. And we talk a lot about that even in our coaching approach, you know, that I don't want to give players all the answers necessarily in practices or our film sessions or whatever. We want to try to create opportunities for them to struggle and to learn together and learn to communicate when they're frustrated or they're not happy with their playing time or they have conflict with their teammates. Like, we try to embrace all of those opportunities as opportunities for development, you know. And I just think sometimes there are adults, and I probably do this with my own kids, that they just shield their kids from too much of that, and it robs them from their ability to develop those skills.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously a 16-month-old is a little bit different than a 3- and 6-year-old, but I find myself when my daughter Kennedy is mad about something, and it's, you know, she's processing so much and learning so much, like, there are times I just sit her down and let her be angry for those 2 minutes, because she needs to figure out how to not be angry at the fact that I put her shoes on, right? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Which is hard to do as a parent, but at the same time, like, I understand that I want her to be as well adjusted. And it's interesting. You retweeted another podcast where the coach is talking about how they don't want to stop, you know, game action and coach and have impact in that moment, because the person on this interview was basically saying that sometimes the best facilitator is the live action. It's the player in the moment helping the other player, which is really interesting to me.
Yeah, I think philosophically that's one of the cornerstones of how we try to teach our skills, is that, you know, rather than constantly interrupting and giving players feedback on their footwork or their release or what we're running offensively or defensively, we try to put them in an environment for them to be able to learn, for them to be able to explore, for them to be able to try things and figure out what works and what doesn't work, and then, you know, give them some guidance or ask some questions or some suggestions along the way. And I think one of the best analogies for that is from Daniel Coyle's book, The Talent Code. And he talks about the flight simulator, you know, that in the run-up to World War II, countries around the world were struggling with training pilots because when they made mistakes in training, they died. And so, you know, the human cost of that, you know, that kind of live action training, was enormous, right? And so when, I can't remember what his name is, but when the guy developed the flight simulator, which actually happened 20 years prior to that, but nobody was interested in it. And then all of a sudden the U.S. Air Force says, maybe we need to look at this Liker trainer thing. And so they ended up ordering like 1,500 of them. And their casualties in training went down by almost 100% because now they could, you know, misread their instruments. They could turn the wrong way. They could forget to put the landing gear down. They could crash into a mountain. And they didn't die, you know, yeah. And they could learn from their mistakes. And that's kind of an analogy for how we try to teach skills even in the context of basketball, is just to create an environment that requires the skills that we want them to improve to be able to win the game or accomplish the objective. But we give them some space and practice to make mistakes, process those mistakes, learn from those mistakes, you know, in hope that they can discover what leads to success, you know, on their own or with some guidance from us as coaches.
Yeah, that I'm going to make a connection to a basketball movie, Hoosiers, which I'm sure you've seen. Mm-hmm. There's a great scene in there that what you just said kind of connects with me. The coach, I can't think of his TV name, but Gene Hackman is playing the coach in the movie. He intentionally gets ejected from the game to force the players and his assistant, a shooter to execute, you know, and which is so, like, that would be terrifying, but at the same time, to your point, coaching and teaching is all about those live moments and learning as you go, which is true in sports, as true in life.
And if I could add to that too, I think philosophically, one of the things that we've done more and more of over the years, I host a podcast called the Coaching Culture Podcast with J.C. Nurbin, and you know, we talk a lot about how you can't have great leaders on your sports teams if you don't allow them opportunities to lead. You know, if you have team captains that are ceremonial, they go to the coin toss, you know, maybe they are the last one seed in practice or whatever, but they don't have any real responsibility or input, you're not really going to develop real leadership unless you get sort of the right kid kind of comes through your program at the right time. And so what we've learned over the years is that to develop leadership, you have to give them opportunities, right? And so, I mean, just to your point about the example in Hoosiers, every summer we would always allow our captains to coach at least one game in our summer league, you know, where we would just make them the coaches, or if we have injured players, they would coach the game. I'd just sit on the bench at the end, and if they had questions, they could come down and ask me, but I'd tell the officials beforehand, you know, these two girls over here, they're in charge, they got the clipboard. If they ask for a timeout, I mean, they are coaching the game, you know.
They're getting the timeout, yeah.
Yeah, and so they get the perspective that they wouldn't normally think from, you know, from a coach's perspective. They're starting to think about rotations and changes in offense and defense, and there's a lot going on, you know, in the context of the game that they don't necessarily, you know, realize when they're just playing the game. So I think the more opportunities you can give people to experience leadership in the same way we talked about, you know, growing basketball skills in a particular game setting, that's where people really have the opportunity to grow as leaders as well.
Have you been looking for the next best clothing brand? I found it for you. It's Bruck & Co. Their designs are awesome. Their clothes fits great. They feel good. They look good. And best yet, you can go from the gym, go to dinner, play with the kids, go to the barbecue. They're utilitarian, and they work everywhere for any occasion. Check them out, bruckandco.com, that's bruckandco.com, to check out their designs, check out their shirts, their other products. I love them. I wear them. I'm proud to support them on this podcast. And for you, our loyal listeners, we have a discount just for you. If you go visit them at bruckandco.com, and use the code LIVEITWELL, LIVEITWELL, just like it sounds, live it well, you'll get 10% off your next purchase. Again, so proud to endorse them. Love their gear, love their designs. They're modern, they're fun, they're different. You're not going to see them anywhere else. Check them out, bruckandco.com. Use the code LIVEITWELL for 10% off. And thank you so much for listening to this show.
So you mentioned in one of your bullet points is all about making a positive impact on the world. And so what really caught my attention to you, Nate, was your wiffle ball field. So tell me about this wiffle ball field, which is I always must just have a thing with baseball fields. So what's the story on the wiffle ball?
Yeah, so the first coaching and teaching job I took was at Loaiza Muscatine, which is down in southeast Iowa, 2A school. Coached there for a couple of years, got married, and my wife and I kind of got this farmhouse outside of town, you know, relatively close. It's a country school. And so over the years, like, we had this garage and this fence that kind of went to nowhere, and we had this huge, like, 50 by 80 foot machine shed kind of foundation with nothing on it, just overgrown with weeds and stuff like that. And so at the time, we led the Fellowship of Christian Athletes group at our school. And so one summer we thought, wouldn't it be fun to clear this kind of foundation off, and we can use the edge of the garage and this fence and a couple trees sort of as an outfield wall, so to speak, and play some wiffle ball. And so we did that. We painted bases on the concrete. We played on the concrete infield with the plastic ball and bats. And I, at the time, had come across a guy named Pat Murphy, who out in Vermont had built a 1/4 scale model of Fenway Park. It's called Little Fenway. And he, over the last, I don't know, 15 or 20 years, has raised over $2 million for different charities by hosting wiffle ball tournaments in his backyard, you know, at this replica model of Fenway. So that was kind of the inspiration that really started us sort of down the path. Eventually, my family, we relocated up to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and moved back out into the country when I took a job at Springville, which is kind of where we live now. So we live kind of off the beaten path, off a gravel road, and as we were looking for houses, you know, to settle into, my wife's looking inside, she's interested in the kitchen and the cabinetry and stuff like that. I'm just outside wandering around the yard thinking, how could we really do this right? You know, really build something that would be an awesome, you know, wiffle ball field. We found this property where we live now that's about 2.5 acres. The house sits right in the middle. The north end, the north acres, become like a parking lot. It's got its own area that's fed by a farmer's entrance next to the field. And in the south end, we brought in a bulldozer 6 years ago. It was kind of this gentle rolling hill that kind of emptied into a cornfield. And we flopped the hill over to flatten it out and kind of make this pad or this surface, and we started building a wall. So me and my buddies went out the first summer, and we probably, you know, hit hundreds and hundreds of wiffle balls out there trying to figure out wind patterns and how far does the ball go and what would be the right dimensions for the wall and the distances and the bases and all that. And we put up a snow fence, what we thought would be the best kind of outline of the field, put a snow fence up, and we hosted our first tournament out here. We raised $900 for the charity in town that our churches kind of contribute to. And so the next summer, my wife, her brother, that is from Western Iowa and farms out there, but he's like a construction guru. So, you know, we go home for Christmas and I'd say, hey, I got these great ideas. How do I build a wall, you know, in the middle of this yard? And so he started coming over about a week every summer. He'll come over, and whatever we've dreamed up, we will build. So the first summer, we built a wall, and we put in an irrigation system. We resodded it, you know, we put all the bases down and everything, pointing track, the whole deal, and hosted three events. And then the next summer, we had an old grain bin foundation that's kind of next to the wiffle ball field that was just, again, overgrown kind of mess. Cleaned it off. We put a roof over the top of it. Now we got a gazebo right next to it that, you know, people can sit in, watch the games, continue to host a couple events a year. You know, then the summer after that, our right field wall is 12.5 feet tall, so it's kind of a, like a green monster. The green monster in real life is in left field. We put it in right field, mostly because I'm a right-handed hitter and I didn't want to have to hit it over the big wall. So we put it in right field, and my brother-in-law said, well, what if we built like a deck behind it? People could stand and lean over the 12-foot wall and watch the game. So we did that. We got this two-tiered deck on the right field wall. People can sit up there and lean over and watch the game. And then the next summer was 2016. The Cubs made it to World Series, so I spent my wiffle ball budget on World Series tickets and was actually at Game 7 in Cleveland when they won it, so that was pretty exciting. We didn't do anything more on the wiffle ball field that summer, but the following, so this would be a couple years ago, we built a little bit of a porch on that overhangs left field. Last summer, we built kind of a playground off of that, so there's a porch on left field over the wall, and off the back, there's swings and slides and stuff for our kids to play on. And then this summer we started building an upper deck. This sounds crazy, but an upper deck in right field and left field that are two-tiered seating, and they've got a roof over the top of it, and just another extension kind of some of the decking. So at any rate, in the 6 years, 7 years that we've been doing this, we've raised over $30,000 for local charities, and we'll have groups come in churches will use it, businesses will come out and do it, you know, a fun activity day or whatever. And we don't take any of the money for ourselves. So everything that people use for rental fees or event fees or whatever, we just agree on a charity and they make their usage donation, you know, to whatever that organization is. And so for us, it's been a great opportunity to use the space that we have. It's really fun for our family to have a wiffle ball field in the backyard, and, you know, our friends bring their kids over and hit balls and play all the time. So it's become a place where people like to gather. And we can use it to raise money to help people that are in need. So,
first of all, it's amazing. And so bravo to you and your family and the community for doing this and supporting it. But I mean, it's a cool idea. And the photo, so I'll link to the KWWL story into the show notes if you want to see one of the photos. It looks like a ton of fun. Like it's just, and the fact that you have, you know, playground and made it kind of accessible for everyone, is just incredible. So bravo to you and the whole crew.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. It's been a lot of fun. And, you know, I think, like I said in that, when the news came down and did a story a couple of weeks ago, you know, one of the fun things about wiffle ball compared to a lot of other sports is that it's accessible to a wide range of people's athletic ability. You know, we have grandparents that come out here and they'll take some swings, you know, and you've got my daughter 6 and 7 and she's trying to play in the games, you know, and can hold her own to an extent, you know what I mean? And so it's not like playing full court basketball, you know, or something like that, where it can be an uneven playing field, you know, depending on age and athletic ability. So so that's one of the things that makes it a lot of fun too.
So does this ballpark favor righties, lefties, the pitcher? What's kind of the 4-1 on the field?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So first of all, we play with kind of adopted FCA rules. So we actually have teams pitch to their own team because we found that it's more fun to get the ball in play than it is to, you know, strike out 17 out of 27 batters, you know, or whatever. So so we play with 42-foot bases pitch to your own team. So you start with a 1-0 count. Anything that you don't swing at is a ball until you get 3 balls, and everything's a strike, so you can't strike out your own teammates, which is kind of funny when it happens. But what's interesting and I think fun about the way the field plays is that depending on the wind, if the wind is blowing out of the west, then it's blowing straight out to left field. If it's blowing, you know, from the south, it's blowing in, and it's really hard to hit a home run. If it's blowing out of the north, it's pushing out. You know, so depending on the day, in fact, I tell people this story, the first year that we started playing games with the wall we have now, we played a tournament in August, and the wind was blowing, just warm summer day, strong breeze out of the south. We played 22 games that day. There was 4 home runs that were hit over the fence. 2 weeks later, we're playing on a cool Saturday afternoon. There's a breeze out of the north, and we had 80 home runs over the fence in 20 games. So it really changes depending on the weather conditions, which I think makes it even more fun. So
that's incredible. I love it. So I always end every interview with 4 fun random questions. So don't think too hard about these at all. Question 1, what is your hidden talent?
Well, I can play guitar a little bit and I can play some piano. So I don't do that in front of a lot of people, but I do enjoy noodling a little bit on the guitar and the piano.
That's a good one. No one has said that one yet, so I like that. What is your favorite kind of pizza?
I love Giordano's pizza. I was so excited when a Giordano's landed in West Des Moines. I've been
West
there like 4 times. Yeah, it's I love the Chicago-style deep dish sausage pizza. Love it.
It's a good pie. What song or artist is your go-to?
This is probably going to be a little bit obscure, but one of my closest friends in life is a recording artist and lives out in the Seattle area. His name is Andrew Landers, and he actually lived in Muscatine, and was a worship pastor down there when my family lived down there. So I kind of met him that way, and I've just kind of followed his career. He's got a number of albums and does, you know, all kinds of stuff. Lives out west now, but, his stuff is pretty amazing. So Main Street Struggleville is the name of his band. But he's pretty good stuff.
I love the name. That's kind of cool. Then the last question, what is your favorite word?
My favorite word is probably just love. I think, you know, everything that we come back to, whether it's how we're trying to use our yard, the relationships that we're trying to build in our life and our coaching, it really comes back to just trying to love other people and serve other people. So I don't know that I use that word a lot because sometimes it can be a little misconstrued, you know, but if you ask what, you know, is really at the core of the motivation of what we do, that's probably what it is.
Awesome. Well, Nate, I appreciate you joining the show. Where and how can people find you or get in touch with you if they want to do that?
Yeah, the easiest way is probably just on Twitter. You can find me at Coach N. Sanderson, and shoot me a DM there. You can follow me there. We post some things about wiffle ball and coaching and our podcast and all kinds of different things. The Wiffle Ball Field, if you're interested in more pictures, you can find, we have a page on Facebook, just facebook.com/thewiffleballfield, all one word. And if you went through our photos of the last 6 years, you'll kind of see the evolution of different things that we've added to the field and announcements about upcoming events and that sort of thing.
Awesome. I'll make sure to link that in the show notes as well to make it easy for people. So cool. Iowa has some of the coolest things. So it's another one of those hidden gems that hopefully people enjoy. So again, Nate, thank you so much for joining the show.
Hey, appreciate the opportunity.
I mean, how awesome is the idea of a wiffle ball field where you have weekend tournaments and you raise money for good causes? Just, I'm still astounded by it. I cannot wait to go check this thing out for myself. And if you're ever rolling through Eastern Iowa, look it up and check it out too. The link to Nate and the ball field are in the show notes, as well as his own podcast where he talks about coaching. Really insightful and kind of to me, a modern day approach to what a coach should be. There's a line from the movie Spotlight. It's about newspaper and the newspaper world, and the editor of this particular section calls himself a player coach because he's coaching his writers, but he's also a writer at heart. He's a player, and I think that's how I want to describe Nate as a coach. I didn't have him as coach, but just talking to him and kind of getting his coaching philosophy, he's a player coach. He wants the players to do the best they can, find the right teaching moments, and let the athletes coach themselves. Let the kids learn their lessons as they go. And that's such a metaphor to life. You know, we all go through challenges and we all go through trials and tribulations and we ask for help, and that's a good thing. But life is about living those experiences and making sure that you learn along the way so that you build up your own tolerance, your own immunity to various challenges and obstacles. And when you do that, you become a stronger person and you're empowered to tackle those challenges. And so it was such a great conversation with Nate. I wish more coaches had his perspective, and I hope more gain that perspective as we go, because it's so important to have a coach, a leader who understands the value of silence and letting the player figure it out. And I mentioned my old tennis coach who always had a mantra, and I think I've said it in a couple interviews this season. He would tell us, smarter, not harder. And that's so true to sports and life. And so if you take nothing else, I would say for me, take that. Work smarter, not harder. Play smarter, not harder. When you're looking at relationships, do smarter, not more. Like, figure it out as you go, but be smart about that approach. Oh, thank you so much, Nate. Thank you for listening. And until next week, I hope you live it well. If you love this episode, if you're loving this series, please do go leave us a rating. It means the world. I read them all. And it helps other people find these episodes as well when people rate them. So please do go hit that, hopefully a 5-star, maybe a 4-star. But I'm loving putting these together, and I'm going to keep doing it. So again, thank you for listening, and I'll see you again in 2 weeks. The music for this episode is Ukulele Fun by Raphael Crux. The credit for the music is found in the show notes. And as always, we can be found online at Live It Well Podcast on Instagram, or you can find me, your host, on Instagram at Richard Vidor. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks.